This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 31st. I'm Max Pringle. Coming up, a New York broadcaster is beaten reporting on the funeral of an unarmed man shot to death by the NYPD. On the West Coast, allegations of police brutality lead to an increase in crime. OPEC agrees to increase oil production, easing prices at the pump. All the while, workers and women in the world's largest oil-producing country continue to suffer under a family dictatorship. All this and more this week on Free Speech Radio News. The funeral for 26-year-old Patrick Dorisman, the latest unarmed black man shot dead by New York City police, turned violent last weekend as police and mourners clashed outside the church. One of those beaten and arrested was Errol Maitland, producer for Pacifica radio station WBAI. Free Speech Radio's Eileen Sutton reports from New York.
An estimated 7,000 mourners marched peacefully from the funeral home to the church, where final services for Patrick Dorisman were held. The mood was somber, there was much sadness and a palpable grief. Though the procession had been calm from the funeral home to the church, many observers said it was clear the stage had been set for confrontation.
The police at every turn acted in a way that was intentionally provocative.
Michael Letwin is president of the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys.
The police were infiltrating the march as it proceeded up Flatbush Avenue. They wouldn't move away. They wouldn't allow the marchers to simply march on their own. They rather came into the march in uniform and interspersed themselves with the marchers. And that, from the beginning, created a tremendous amount of tension.
That tension finally came to a head as crowds pushed against and eventually tossed aside steel barricades blocking their path. Alambe Brath of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition says initially uniformed police fell back, but they were instantly replaced.
A whole phalanx of police with riot batons, truncheons, the plastic shields, the plastic visors and helmets all started coming up in a military fashion. And the police started to tell the people to move off of the street.
Within seconds, confrontations with the police spread through the crowd, and WBAI producer Errol Maitland, reporting live from the scene, was in the middle of the fray.
And they are beating her down to the ground, and she's down on the ground, and they're pushing me.
Though Maitland had no visible press credentials, he repeatedly identified himself as a reporter and continued to describe the actions of the police and the mourners as the chaos intensified. But soon Maitland himself became the target of police assaults.
Yes, so this woman is down on the ground and they are yelling, disperse. Well, she's down on the ground.
Leave the area! Leave the area!
Pushed by the police from the 80th precinct, a grab. It is a deputy inspector.
Leave the area.
So this is the situation.
Leave the area.
Captain Craftsman, could you give us a statement as to what's going on out here? Deputy Inspector, and I've been pushed by a police officer into the crowd, and he said, take him, and he just told him to fuck me up. I've been taught by the police to fuck me up, and I'm down on the ground.
Mimi Rosenberg is a legal aid attorney. She witnessed Maitland's arrest.
One of the officers grabbed him from behind. He was put in a chokehold. He was wrestled by at least three or four cops to the ground, even though he offered absolutely no resistance. Then he was kneed several times. He was face down. There were rather burly officers who were on top of him. He was dragged along the ground somewhat and, of course, was arrested.
Maitland was among 28 arrested. He was taken to a local precinct and finally transported to a hospital at the insistence of his lawyer. Complaining of chest pains, among other injuries, Maitland was quickly placed in the cardiac intensive care unit. Though charged only with disorderly conduct, a simple violation, Maitland was handcuffed to his bed, and an armed police guard was stationed outside his door. He was allowed no visitors. Speaking at a news conference this past Tuesday, Michael Tarif Warren, Maitland's attorney, said the beating and arrest of Maitland marked a new low in the history of the city.
And that low point arises from the very cowardly and totally unwarranted attack upon a person who was functioning not only as a journalist, but more importantly, as a conveyor of the truth.
Maitland was transferred out of intensive care earlier this week, and the guard was finally removed. The NYPD has denied that Maitland was beaten. Attorney Warren suggests Maitland may pursue a civil action against the city. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Eileen Sutton in New York.
Crime has always been a major concern for residents of the low-income, mostly immigrant community of West Los Angeles. But the recent police corruption scandal centered on West L.A.'s Rampart Station has widened the gulf between local residents and the police department. Many residents say crime is likely to increase, and most of them will be less likely to rely on the police for help. Robin Yurovich reports.
20 years ago, Lucia, not her real name, settled into one of the Rampart area's old Victorian houses along with her family and almost immediately became a community activist, organizing cleanups and pushing for more police enforcement. And the neighborhood improved, she says. But since the Rampart scandal came to light, she says she won't work with the police anymore.
Estábamos combatiendo el crimen y el crimen lo teníamos adentro.
We were fighting crime, and we had criminals among us. We were fighting drug trafficking, and we had drug traffickers inside the police department. That makes me really sad and depressed because we fought for 20 years as community volunteers and come to find out that some of the officers we worked with were criminals.
Y ahora darnos cuenta que estábamos trabajando con algunos que eran criminales.
Lucia is a native of Guatemala, where she says she didn't trust the police. But in the U.S., she says she'd always thought they were beyond reproach, even after she had some recent bad experiences. Lucia asked me to turn the tape recorder off while she told this story. She says a young man who she'd befriended was suspected by police of gang involvement. Officers in the anti-gang unit, she said, gave him a tip that she was the one who was pushing for more police enforcement in the neighborhood. And he warned her about it. Still, even though she was shaken up by the incident, she says she continued working with the police until allegations surfaced of their turning over people to the INS to be deported, whether or not they were guilty of crimes.
Queríamos limpiar de los criminales.
We wanted to get rid of criminals, but we didn't want our people deported, and we didn't want immigration here. That's what saddens us, to realize that we lied to our people when we told them to trust the police because they wouldn't work with immigration.
Lucia says she'll continue being an activist, but not with the police. And not until there's been a complete overhaul of the department, and she's sure she can trust them. A few blocks away, Jasmine Corona, a young homeowner, says she's seen an increase in graffiti and drug dealing lately. She thinks because police are reluctant to be as visible or make arrests. And she says she and her neighbors will foot the bill when the city pays the estimated $300 million in lawsuits arising from the Rampart scandal.
Either way, the community is the one that gets the bad end of the stick. Oh, whether it be with the lawsuit, which is going to come out of taxpayers' money, or funds that will help the community.
Still, she says she supports the police. Crime has also been a huge issue for Reverend Jeff Carr, who runs a youth center a few miles from the neighborhood where Lucia and Jasmine live.
You know, last summer, in August, we lost 5 kids in 5 days by gunshots. I had 2 of my staff and a volunteer were driving home, and there was a drive-by right behind them. They pulled over, and a kid died in the arms of one of my staff members from a drive-by shooting. That was the first shooting of in the next 5 days of 5 kids dying. And that, to me, is unacceptable.
Carr says the kids he works with not only dodge gangs, they deal with police abuse as well. He says he's seen officers burst into his center and rough up kids who aren't involved in crime. That's why Carr joined the local community policing effort, hoping to build better relations between youth and police. But he says police officers were not willing to listen, even when he made suggestions on things like youth curfews.
I mean, if they're not going to listen to me about youth curfews, have a conversation between police officers and young people about how to implement this thing, you think they're going to listen to somebody from the neighborhood about how to attack the gang problem? I don't think so.
Carr says community policing meetings were more like lecture sessions where he and others listened to the police but couldn't give much input. Captain Bob Hansen is the commanding officer at Rampart now. He denies he's lost the confidence of the neighborhood.
The people that I talk to, I mean, the people on the advisory board particularly, the people on my booster organization that I have here who live and work here and have not given up on Rampart and never have. If you're getting that message from people you're talking, I'd like to talk to them.
Hansen claims the problems at Rampart are in the past, but he says news reporting on the scandal has emboldened gang members. Gang crime, he says, is up 40%, according to his detective.
Gang members are more brazen, I think, in dealing in committing crime. They feel like they're kind of home free now. I think that's the rationale that some gang members have. You arrest me, you're from Rampart, I'll just say I didn't do it.
Hansen could not provide statistics that isolated gang crime. Overall, crime is down 7%. Community policing and police relations with the community are likely to come under greater scrutiny in the months to come. As LA's Police Commission evaluates the city's compliance with recommendations made by the Christopher Commission, a blue ribbon panel chaired by former Secretary of State Warren Christopher in the wake of the city's last police scandal, the Rodney King beating. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Urovich in Los Angeles.
In what was called Seattle 2, in reference to the demonstrations that disrupted the World Trade Organization ministerial last year, some 3,000 activists descended on Boston this week to protest a meeting of top movers and shakers in biotechnology. The Bio 2000 conference drew activists from all over the eastern United States and Canada. Protesters disrupted conference meetings, dumped bioengineered food into Boston Harbor, and held their own conference, dubbed Bio Devastation 2000. Amanda Sheehy reports from Boston.
It's said that the fastest way to a person's heart is through their stomach. Last weekend proved that the issue of genetically modified food has finally made it to the hearts of Americans. Between 3,000 and 4,000 people took to the streets in Boston last Sunday to peacefully protest against the Biotechnology Industry Organization's annual conference. In what is being called the largest gathering against the biotechnology industry in North America, people united to claim their rights to choose what kind of food they eat and to tell the world that they are hungry for more democratic control over their lives. The festivities started with a huge rally at 1 p.m. at Copley Square on Sunday, only a couple of blocks away from the Biotechnology Industries Conference. The spacious square quickly filled with giant puppets, information tables, music, food, and fun.
This is what democracy looks like, people in power! This is what democracy looks like, people in power! This is what democracy looks like!
The people united will never be defeated! The people united will never be defeated!
While some people came out for the entertainment, others had a very good idea about why they were there.
We want the moratorium on further production of these technologies. We want the criminalization of viral piracy. We want indigenous people to have the right to own the food that they developed for the last 10,000 years.
It's obvious that this demonstration, along with the many other direct actions planned for the rest of the week, are carrying the momentum of opposition to the global economy that started in Seattle last December.
I am here because the biotech industry and other transnational corporations are trying to control people's food resources, they're trying to control people's water resources, they're trying to turn everything into material for private profit, and that hurts poor people worldwide and that hurts the environment worldwide.
I think that we are living in an economic dictatorship. I don't think that democracy exists anymore, and I think we as the people need to take back that power.
Predominantly, people felt that there has not been enough public discussion about biotechnology.
I think there has to be some sort of public debate about it all, because up until now, this has all been happening kind of secretly, at least in this country. The corporations, who in my opinion are incestuously involved with the government, are just getting away with doing whatever they want to, and the people just have no say in it. And somehow or other, has to be some forum for people to talk these issues out.
For some, this ultimately represents a crisis in democracy.
It is not enough to be GMO-free. We want direct democracy! This is the time. This is the place. This is the movement that is going to build as we go to D.C., as we go to the next action and the next action.
Many solutions were proposed, ranging from labeling to a moratorium on GE food to reworking democracy as we know it. Martha Stegman, a community gardener from Montreal, Canada, proposed the following.
And if we're going to get rid of a corporate-dominated, profit-driven model of agriculture that's ecologically and socially devastating, we have to think about what we're going to replace that with. And I want to be a part of a world where I see a lot more community-supported agriculture projects, and I see a lot more people supporting regional organic family farmers, and where the food that I buy that comes from other countries has been fair traded and not freely traded. And I want to see positive food production models that produce social human relations and foster community and give people power over their own lives.
With such a wide spectrum of voices being offered to the debate, it remains to be seen what direction the anti-biotech movement is going in. The only sure thing is that people are fed up with having their food and ultimately their lives in the hands of corporations. For Free Speech Radio and Independent Media Center, this is Amanda Sheedy in Boston.
As OPEC nations agreed to increase oil production, perhaps leading to relief at the pump, Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil producer, routinely violates the most fundamental human rights for its residents. Still, the Middle Eastern kingdom escapes international criticism because of its immense oil wealth and alliance with Western powers. I had a chance to speak with Robby Aridi, an Amnesty International Middle East expert. I started by asking him about some of the more egregious abuses.
I can give you some examples of some of the things that are happening there are and continue to happen. Someone by the name of Abdul Karim Mukashabandi, he was beheaded after being tortured into signing a confession, and then he was convicted of witchcraft during his secret and a summary trial. Someone else by the name of Said Khutaim and others, Rahim Abdullah Salami and others, they were executed in Mecca in December 1992 after they were found guilty of engaging in homosexuality. Another Yemeni national by the name of Mohammad Raji, he had his fingers amputated. And the list goes on and on and on. A woman by the name of Donato Lama, she was arrested for preaching Christianity and tortured into signing a confession and sentenced to 18 months imprisonment and 70 lashes. An Egyptian national by the name of Muhammad Ali Al-Sayed was convicted of robbery in 1990 and received the most lashes in a single case recorded by Amnesty International, which was 4,000 lashes. So this just gives you a small example of the magnitude and the level of human rights violations that take place in Saudi Arabia and continue to take place in Saudi Arabia.
Tell me a little bit about the Saudi judicial system. Do the accused have a right to defend themselves with lawyer? Are they granted a lawyer? And how fair are the trials?
Well, in theory, as you probably know, the Saudi government is a signatory to the Convention Against Torture and the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. However, in practice, this is not really happening. The accused in Saudi Arabia, in most cases, do not have the right to a lawyer, do not get to see a lawyer. They do not get to be present when charges are being brought against them, and sometimes the entire trial is held in utmost secrecy, and a decision is made. The right to appear in theory is available, but it's not effective at all. So the entire system really does not give the accused a chance, in our opinion.
Tell me a little bit about the difficulties faced by human rights workers in trying to document what's going on there.
Well, it's extremely difficult because the government does not allow any special rapporteurs into the country, so everything is held in utmost secrecy, and which makes it extremely difficult to document what takes place because everything is handled in a manner that makes it extremely difficult to get the information you need. So the information we've been gathering and researching over the years had been with people who were able to get out of Saudi Arabia and tell us what's been happening over and over again.
So rights workers really can't operate within the country itself?
No, it's very difficult. As you probably know, there are no NGOs in Saudi Arabia. There are no human rights organizations in the country, and it's extremely difficult to document what takes place in Saudi Arabia.
We hear so little about what goes on in that country in regard to human rights. Why do you think that is?
The U.S. government does not want to embarrass the Saudi government, so they like to avoid raising the issue of human rights. They think this is a very sensitive issue, and they try as much as they can not to bring it to light. Human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia do not seem to be of prime importance to the U.S. government. And the U.S. feels that the Saudi government is a very important ally. Of course, we beg to differ with this policy because we feel that human rights should be respected irrespective of political or economic interests. And secondly, I'd also like to mention this point. You know, history has shown over and over again that more stability is created when individuals' basic human rights are respected. So if the U.S. government wants this special relationship with the Saudi government to continue, then we feel they should stress the need to respect human rights.
Do you think the U.S. is especially unwilling to confront the Saudi government just because of its the region where it is? This is the major oil producer, and what do you think about that?
Right, yes, I agree. I mean, it's a very sensitive geopolitical region, and the Saudi government, again, is a very important ally. So they would like to keep the balance the way it is. However, we have raised this issue with the State Department on numerous occasions, and they said they've been raising these issues with Saudis over the years, over and over again. But we fail to see any progress. We fail to see any improvement. So it seems to us that these issues are always going to take a level of secondary importance when it comes to U.S. foreign policy.
Now, do you see the human rights situation there improving any time in the near future?
To be honest with you, we don't see any improvement or any significant improvements, but we are hoping that maybe through launching this campaign and educating the public and bringing into light what's happening in Saudi Arabia, hopefully we'll be able to create some difference.
Robbie Aridi, Amnesty International's Middle East Specialist, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
A year after NATO bombs began dropping on Yugoslavia, questions remain as to the future of the UN-controlled Kosovo province. Kosovar Albanians have driven out nearly all of the province's Serb, Romani, and moderate Albanian populations as they take revenge for repression suffered under the Belgrade regime. All this is happening under the noses of NATO KFOR peacekeepers. What's the role of the media in healing old wounds and encouraging multi-ethnic harmony? As Sputnik Colombia reports from Pristina, Radio Blue Sky, a joint Swiss UN project, is doing its part.
Kosovo is in a kind of limbo at the moment, a year after NATO used its military might to wrest the Albanian-majority province from the grip of Belgrade. Slobodan Milosevic is still in power, though his country is in economic shambles. The events of the last year have all but made it unthinkable that Kosovo remain in the Yugoslav Federation, and for the majority of Kosovars, the current foreign occupation, as it were, smacks of freedom, a short step away from full independence. But under the terms of last year's United Nations resolution that put Kosovo under international administration, the UN mandate runs out in June, after which the province returns to Belgrade's rule, though under certain conditions. The UN resolution calls for substantial autonomy for Kosovo, not for statehood. NATO may have won the war but has failed to keep the peace, is the latest catchphrase, and the UN has its hands tied because of the ambiguity of its mandate and more urgently because its coffers are empty. Serb-Albanian relations are tense, to say the least. Speaking Serbian on the streets is a sure way of inviting trouble. Serbs have fled Kosovo in droves, and those that remain live in enclaves under the protection of KFOR peacekeeping troops. It is in this context that the Swiss NGO Hirondelle set up Radio Blue Sky, one of the few multi-ethnic media outlets in Pristina. Blue Sky is also part of the UN mission in Kosovo, but there were many who believed that a project like Blue Sky couldn't get off the ground. Station manager, Therese Obrecht.
We are kind of laboratory experiment. We're working inside barbed wire, that is the UN compound. So it works very well. And I'm quite aware that outside of the barbed wire, it wouldn't work. And the Serbs who work with us, as soon as they leave the compound, they're in danger. And on the other hand, I really think the experience is worth it because the people who work with us, they see that then they can get over the hatred. They can work together and even be friends, have fun, and respect each other and learn a lot more about the problems of the other community than if they were separated. So even if it's on a very small scale, I think it was worth it.
Blue sky. Lajmet.
Mirë mbrëma, unë quhem Lulzi Mjeku, po dëgjoni det pas det edicion e lajmeve. Nga ngjarët e ditës veçuam këto.
It was very hard for us, having in mind that we should broadcast the program in both languages and having in mind our public opinion that the wounds are still fresh from the war and that the Serbian language is not desirable to be listened from our public opinion. We had some reactions at the beginning, and now we have our listeners, mainly young people.
A year ago, you were covering the war, you saw some pretty horrible things. Did you think something like this could be possible?
I thought it could be possible after 4 years or five, because of war in Bosnia. I was comparing that the international community is reacting slowly, as in Bosnia. I didn't expect that it might happen so soon, that the war is over. So now we're trying to put aside in our memory this sad past.
Sub-editor Lulzi Meku is one of the few Blue Sky staff with previous journalistic experience, though he recalls Riley having worked without pay throughout the past year covering the conflict, the exodus and the return. A return many hope will be a new beginning, though most people believe the odds don't look good. 23-year-old Ana Repic is one of the few Serbs working at Blue Sky. She still feels she belongs in this troubled area, despite the radical dwindling of its Serb minority.
Here in Blue Sky, I feel like part of one society, want to work and to live. I think this is a very good sign for the future.
Ana Repic may have to be accompanied when she goes home. She can't speak Serbian on the streets, but at Blue Sky, she's part of the team. Her Albanian colleagues have no problem switching to Serbian when they speak to her, accompanying her to the shops if need be, or ensuring that she gets home safe. For UN journalist Lena Jakamopoulou, people like Ana mean there's hope for the future.
I think they're heroes. Certainly if I was Serbian, I wouldn't stay here. I would be too scared. One can't even speak Serbian in public. And originally, most of them were living within the center of Pristina. Some of them have had to go out to Gracanica, a Serbian village, and they're escorted by the UN. And so their social life is severely limited. They can only stay within the UN compound. So I really do think they're heroes.
Radio Blue Sky is perhaps a mere drop on the Kosovo landscape, but the airwaves may yet take the message further afield. I'm Sputnik Kilambi.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 Pacifica reporters from across Europe, Asia, and the Americas have been on strike for over a month to protest censorship of legitimate news stories at Pacifica Network News. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. To find out more about the strike, go to www.savepacifica.net/strike. That's www.savepacifica.net/strike. Free Speech Radio News is produced by Aaron Glantz and Andrea Sears. Matt Martin is distribution coordinator. Technical assistance from Bob Mason and Josh Thayer. Thanks to the National Radio Project for leasing a space. I'm Max Pringle. Thanks for listening.